that clear statement requirement is satisfied and provided that the condition is germane to the purpose of the funding, then Congress can attach conditions, and it could do so in this area.
Let me switch to an ethics issue that is not Vanguard. As you know, after your testimony concludes today, a number of outside witnesses are coming to testify about your nomination, including seven current and former judges from your court. As far as I know, this is the first time that sitting federal judges have testified on behalf of a Supreme Court nominee, and I'm a little troubled by it. I hope to have some opportunity to question the judges about this, but I think it may raise something of an ethical issue for you. If you're confirmed to the Supreme Court, how would you analyze a possible recusal motion if an appeal on a case from one of those sitting judges testifying on your behalf were to come before you? Will you have to recuse yourself from any case or one of these judges was involved in the decision?
That's not a question that I've given any thought to before this minute, Senator, so I don't know that I could answer it, and I would want to answer any recusal question very carefully.
Perhaps you could give me an answer after you've had a chance to think about it?
I'd certainly be happy to do that.
Appreciate that. Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that is sufficient. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Senator Feingold. We're on course to finish you before lunchtime, Judge Alito. We have more potential questions from the Republican side, and we have two more Democratic side. Senator DeWine, do you have any questions?
Chairman, I reserve my time.
Senator DeWine reserves his time. Senator Schumer, you're recognized for up to 25 minutes.
Thank you.
Charles Schumer, Democrat of New York.
With our conversation that you're going to ask new questions?
That's what I want to ask, but I think
it's a new day.
I think some of my old questions, the ones I've asked before, should bother you. They bother me. But in any case, I do have a few other issues that I do want to talk to you about. The first is just a general question on presidential power. Let's just assume that it was found that the president's right to wiretap people, the way we're discussing it now in terms of the recent NSA revelations, was found constitutional. Would there be a different standard if, say, the president, does that necessarily allow the president to then go ahead and go into people's homes here in America, American citizens, without a warrant? Does the one necessarily lead to the other?
I would have to understand the I would have to see the ground for holding the wiretapping or the electronic surveillance constitutional before seeing whether it would apply in the case of other searches and seizures.
But let's assume it is constitutional.
But I have to know what the arguments were made about it and on what ground it was found to be.
So it could follow but might not. Is that what you would say?
It very well might not. I have to know the constitutional ground for the decision relating to the wiretapping, and I have no idea what that would be. It might well not extend to things like physical searches of homes.
Well, is there a difference? Is there a constitutional difference between a wiretap and an actual physical search of the home on Fourth Amendment grounds?
Well, There are differences. Yes, there certainly are.
Thank you.
Wiretapping is subject to general criminal wiretapping is subject to all the rules that are set out in Title III, which are thought to be based in large part on Fourth Amendment requirements. Mm-hmm. The warrant requirement is very strong in the area of electronic
exactly.
surveillance. When you're talking about other types of searches, the searches can take place in a variety of places for a variety of reasons.
But if it can be done under the inherent power that the president has for the one, why couldn't it be done for the other? I'm not asking about the statute.
There's also a Fourth Amendment issue. Any
in both cases.
In both cases, and the Fourth Amendment could play out very differently in those two contexts.
Okay. Now I'd like to go back to some of the line of questioning that Senator Durbin explored yesterday when he mentioned the crushing hand of fate, Bruce Springsteen. Judge Alito, I assume you believe that you will be able to be fair in every case that comes before you on the Supreme Court.
I have no reason to think I will not be. I certainly will.
And you don't believe that you've prejudged any legal or constitutional issue?
I don't believe that I have.
And you'll take care to apply the rules of law and procedure equally and even-handedly, no matter who the parties are? Prosecution or defense?
Certainly will, yes, Senator.
Employer or employee?
I will apply the laws even-handedly to everyone.
And I believe you believe that you've done just that on the Third Circuit while you were there.
I believe I have.
Okay. Now, yesterday, Senator Durbin asked about Parolee v. World Flavors, and you remember that case. You discussed it with Senator Durbin, and the case involves the claims of a mentally retarded man who brought suit against his employer for violent and persistent sexual harassment by his coworkers. Am I right?
Those were the claims.
Yeah. And the majority allowed the case to proceed, finding that the court had, quote, discretion to consider issues not raised in the brief. And they did so to give the plaintiff his day in court. You exercised your discretion to vote against giving him his day in court because his lawyer failed to raise the argument in the brief. As you told Senator Durbin, there's a very important principle involved in appellate practice. These are your words. I think it goes with the idea of judicial self-restraint, and that requires parties raise issues in the trial court, and that if they don't raise the issue in the trial court, then absent some extraordinary circumstances, they shouldn't be able to raise the issue on appeal, and that was the principle there. Those are your words, right?
I believe they are, yes.
Okay. Now I'd like to go to two other cases that you had when you were on the Third Circuit. The first one is Smith v. Horn, where a similar issue arose. That was a criminal case involving a habeas corpus petition brought by a criminal defendant, right?
Yes, it was.
And it turns out that in that case as well, just like Parolee, one of the parties had failed to raise a relevant argument in its brief, right?
Well, Smith versus Horn was really not comparable to Parolee. For a very important reason. Smith versus Horn was a habeas case. And so what is involved there is not simply a dispute between private parties. And, of course, disputes between private parties are very important, and individual rights can be involved.
I understand it's a government case. Let me
just make — there's more to it than the Senator.
I'm going to let you answer it. I just want to make the point here so everybody can — okay. The majority in Smith v. Horn to say, this time — it was the government that failed to raise the issue in the district court brief. This time you were prepared to excuse that failure. This time you felt it was appropriate to consider the issue on your own. And I'm at a loss to understand the difference. I'm going to give you a chance to explain, but I want to read what the majority in Smith v. Horn had to say about your indulgence of the government for failing to bring up an issue, just as the retarded person did with Parolee. They said, where the state has never raised the issue at all in any court, raising the issue ourselves puts us in the untenable position of ferreting out possible defenses upon which the state has never sought to rely. When we do so, we come dangerously close to acting as advocates for the state rather than as impartial magistrates. So as far as I can see, the legal principle and procedural rule in each case was precisely the same. The only difference being that the first was a sexual harassment plaintiff who left out an argument, and in the second, it was the government who did. In the first case, you said to that retarded individual, sorry, you're out of luck. In the second case, you said to the government, I'll make your argument for you. And that doesn't seem even-handed to me. Can you explain the difference?
Yes, Senator. Please. As I was attempting to explain a couple of minutes ago, there is an important principle called the principle of comity that is involved in habeas cases. And it goes to a critical part of our concept of federalism. And it's something that Congress itself has very strongly recognized in the habeas corpus statute. What I'm talking about there is the doctrine of procedural default, which is very closely related to the doctrine of exhaustion. They go hand in hand. And what Congress has said in the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996 is that on the issue of exhaustion, the court has to consider that even if the parties don't raise it.
Now, so that applies to the government as well as to the defendant?
Absolutely. It said the issue of exhaustion must be considered by the federal habeas court even if the state prosecutor does not raise the issue of exhaustion. And why did Congress say that? Congress said that because there's something more involved here than a dispute between the state prosecutor and the habeas petitioner. There is respect for the federal system and the federal system of government involved. There is respect for the state court system involved.
But the majority didn't agree with you in that situation, did they?
The majority, but what I'm saying, Senator, is that the underlying principle of comity makes this case, makes Smith versus Horn, quite different from a dispute between private parties. Now, the Supreme Court has said that it is appropriate in certain circumstances for the court to consider procedural default sua sponte, and that's what I thought we should do there. And my position
Let me ask you, I understand your explanation. I'm not sure I agree with it, but let me go on to another one. This is Dillinger. In this case, it was with a corporation. The case is Dillinger v. Caterpillar. And it's also a case where a party didn't raise an issue at trial. Won't have the same explanation as the habeas case, obviously. They didn't raise the issue at trial or on appeal. This time a large company didn't, Caterpillar. And the majority held that it was waived, and it sided with the plaintiff, who was seriously injured in the accident, right?
I don't have a recollection of all of the facts.
Okay. Well, let me tell you, just maybe this will refresh your recollection. The majority wrote that it was not appropriate to exercise its discretion, again, it was the majority, to excuse the defendant company's waiver when the consequence of the decision would be to deprive a seriously injured plaintiff of a trial in conformity with applicable law. That's the majority. You dissented. With the result, had you prevailed, that the accident victim's case would have been over. The majority described your approach as follows, quote, "There is an insurmountable procedural difficulty with Judge Alito's position. Caterpillar never advanced this argument at trial, an oversight that Judge Alito excuses on a ground that a district court decision may be affirmed on an alternative ground, though not advanced at trial." So in the Dillinger case, you also thought it was appropriate to use your discretion to excuse Caterpillar, and isn't that right?
Well, I'd have to refresh my recollection about exactly what was involved in the case. There is
Can you explain the difference between the two for us? In one case it was okay and why in another case it wasn't?
Senator, I'd have to refresh my recollection about Dillinger, but what you've just mentioned relates to the principle that it is appropriate for an appellate court to affirm a decision of a lower court on an alternative ground when the basis for that is apparent from the record of the case. So if the facts that if it's a purely legal issue, for example, and you're talking about whether you're going to affirm or whether you're going to reverse.
Yeah, but was that the case in Dillinger?
Well, without refreshing my recollection, I wouldn't be able to say.
Well,
but what you read
I would posit to you that, again, it was an example of you're seeming to have more sympathy for a certain type of plaintiff than another. But what I'd like to do, Mr. Chairman, is just ask permission that Judge Alito could respond to the difference, which he hasn't been able to do here because he doesn't recall the details of the case in writing. The next few days.
Is that acceptable to you, Judge
Alito? Certainly is, Senator, yes.
Because he can then look at the case and explain to us why he thought it was different.
With Judge Alito's agreement, that will be the procedure.
Thank you. Next, strict construction. President Bush has stated his beliefs that judges should be strict constructionists, rigidly adhere to the letter of the Constitution. He's described you as a strict constructionist who favors judicial restraint. So I'd just like to explore one particular issue with you. First, as you said before, there are certain very straightforward questions that are easy to interpret. It says no person shall, Article 1, Section 3, no person shall be a senator who will not have attained the age of 30 years. That was a section you mentioned at our individual meeting. And there's no way that it could be constitutional, I suppose, for a 27-year-old to become a senator. Correct? It's easy. That's strict construction easy.
I can't think of a reason why that would not be the
good.
Case.
Me either. Lucky for them. Next, another one. No person except a natural-born citizen or a citizen of the United States at the time of the adoption of this Constitution shall be eligible to the office of president. So there's no way without a constitutional amendment that say, I know Senator Hatch has a bill that say Arnold Schwarzenegger could become president under the current circumstances. That's easy.
Well, I don't want to express a view about the constitutionality of Senator Hatch's bill.
No, it's a constitutional amendment.
A constitutional
amendment. I'm just asking you very simply, you would need
But a natural-born citizen can be the president of the United States.
Now I want to ask you about the 14th Amendment, which sets forth the definition of citizenship. It states in relevant part, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction, therefore, are citizens of the United States. All persons means all persons. That's pretty easy. Do you agree this is a fairly clear and straightforward provision of the Constitution?
There are active legal disputes about the meaning of that provision at this time.
Right. But given the clear language, could Congress pass a statute, not a constitutional amendment, denying citizenship to a person born in the United States?
And I know that there are proposals to do that. I know that it's an issue that is in play. And if it were to come before me, then I would have to go through the whole judicial process of
decision. Is there any way that you can see just off the top of your head here that that kind of statute would be constitutional?
Well, Senator, on issues that can come before me in litigation, I need to apply the same standard that previous nominees have applied, and that's no hints and no previews. And they may turn out to be easy issues, they may turn out to be hard issues, but I can't opine on them here. Off the cuff, I would have to go through the process.
Just make the argument. You don't even have to tell us how you decide. What imaginable argument could there be for a statute that Congress could not that Congress could deny the citizenship to those born in the United States, say, on the grounds that their parents were illegal aliens? Is there any constitutional argument that you can see off the top of your head?
Senator, I don't want to say anything that any – what? No, could I answer the question, Senator? I don't want to say anything that anybody will characterize as an argument that I am making on one side of this question or on the other side of the question. I know that an argument is being made by people who favor this kind of legislation based on the term – on the language under the jurisdiction of the United States. And I don't know whether that will turn out to – I don't know whether it will come before me. I don't know whether, when it's analyzed, it will turn out to be a compelling argument or a frivolous argument or something in between. And I wouldn't express an opinion.
Judge, I simply asked you to give us an interpretation of one of the most direct and clear provisions in the United States Constitution. And if you can't give us an answer on a very, it seems to me, clear-cut question like that, I find, and I think many of us find, make it difficult to make an assessment of how to vote on your nomination.
Senator, my answer is that it is inappropriate for a sitting judge or for a nominee to a judicial position to offer opinions on constitutional questions that are percolating at that time and may well come before that judge or that nominee. It may turn out to be a very simple question. It may turn out to be a complicated question. Without studying the question, I don't know, and I wouldn't, and even if I had an initial impression, I wouldn't voice it here. I would have to go through the whole judicial decision-making process before reaching a conclusion that I would be willing to express.
But I want to move on now to the Commerce Clause and Rybar. As you know, after you ruled on Rybar, Gonzales v. Raich was decided, and Justice Stevens wrote for the majority the following: our understanding of the reach of the Commerce Clause, as well as Congress's assertion of authority thereunder, has evolved over time. Do you agree with that statement? Has our understanding of the scope of that clause evolved over time, and is it appropriate for our understanding to evolve?
I think our understanding of the reach of the Commerce Clause has evolved as the commercial activity of the country has developed. Commerce in the United States at the time of the adoption of the Constitution was entirely different from commerce in the United States today.
I think most people would agree with that. Maybe
as
not.
As a matter of looking at the development of case law, certainly the case law has developed. The pre-New Deal case law was fundamentally different from the post-New Deal case law, with which I don't have any quarrel.
Right. Good. Here I'm going to read you two views on the Commerce Clause. One, Congress's authority to enact laws necessary and proper for the regulation of interstate commerce is not limited to laws directed against economic activity that have a substantial effect on interstate commerce. Where Congress has the authority to enact a regulation of interstate commerce, it possesses every power needed to make that regulation effective. And there's another view. Under the Commerce Clause, Congress may regulate interstate commerce, not activities that substantially affect interstate commerce. Those are pretty diametrical. I'm not asking for an absolute here, but which one is closer to your view of the Commerce Clause?
Well, the second view is contrary to Supreme Court precedent. It is contrary to even Lopez and Morrison, which says that Congress may regulate activities that substantially affect interstate commerce.
Right. And the first, actually, was Justice Scalia's concurrence in Raich. And the second, even though it may be contrary to precedent, we've talked about precedent before, was actually Justice Thomas's dissent in Raich. So it's obviously a view that has some currency on the court. I'm glad to see you favor the first one. Now, I asked you a question when we met. I asked you, as you know, because we talked about it, I was very troubled by your decision in Rybar and Mr. Chairman, I just don't want to try. Could I get permission for an additional 5 minutes? That's all I'll need.
Makes life easier.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I couldn't be very forceful about it, but yes.
Thank you. I'll take it any way you give it.
Yes.
I asked you in Rybar when we had met, if you would have decided the case differently after Raich, which is quite different than Rybar, and at that point you said you wanted to think about it, and I told you I'd ask you here. So I guess you've thought about it now. So my question is, does the recent Supreme Court decision in Raich, joined by Justice Scalia, whose opinion you said was closer to your view than the other, affect your thinking? More specifically, had Raich been decided before you got Rybar, do you think you would have decided it differently?
Well, Senator, I don't recall making a promise that I would reach a definitive conclusion on the issue.
I didn't know. I asked you to think about it. You said you would. That's all.
And I have thought about it. But what I can say is that I certainly would have thought about Rybar differently had I had Raich available at that time. My effort in Rybar was to follow Supreme Court precedent. At the time, Lopez was the latest expression of the Supreme Court's view of this question. And if it were, if the chronology had been different and I had the benefit of Raich, I would have taken that into account.
Good. Okay. Now, just one other thing on the Commerce Clause. What you're saying, I just want to, there's a possibility, we won't put a percentage on it, that Raich might have changed the outcome of your ruling in or your dissent in Rybar.
Well, it certainly would have changed my thinking and my analysis. Okay. I would have had to take it into account.
We'll take what we can get. Next, as a U.S. attorney, you frequently cross paths with state agencies, particularly law enforcement agencies, And at that point, as I remember, I was a member of Congress, very active in anti-crime legislation. There were all kinds of fights about whether there should be an increased federal role in crime fighting. And you must have dealt with some of those statutes. There was carjacking and trigger lock type offenses. And you must have provided over some prosecutions of local corruption based on an expansion, an expansive federal law theory. Mail fraud was being expanded at that time. These enforcement priorities were tended to be conservative. I agreed with them, but they tended to be conservative priorities. So did your tenure as U.S. attorney affect your thinking on these kinds of situations in terms of the state, the need for federal involvement when the state can't do it? And it brings up, and then I'll let you speak about this for a minute, in the Odometer Act, I can't remember the exact name of it, but the legislation that was Bill S-475 that Senator Feinstein mentioned, you urge disapproval. But it seems to me if that legislation was disapproved, it would have been very difficult for the federal government to regulate odometers because cars that were transferred from one state to the other wouldn't have the same uniform system in terms of their title. And it seems to me, at least, in this world, which is becoming smaller and smaller, that some of the federalism theory that the states should have primacy in regulation just don't make sense. Didn't make sense to me in your decision in Rybar, as we discussed. 90% of the guns used in crimes in New York come from out of state. There's no way New York State could stop them unless they inspected each car that came across the George Washington Bridge. Similarly here, without this federal statute, there's no way the federal government could regulate odometers. It would be ridiculous to ask General Motors to have 50 different standards for 50 different states. And similarly, as U.S. attorney, there were areas where it was better for, particularly in our interconnected world, for the federal government to prevail. And yet here you were saying, you were working for the administration, but they ultimately rejected your view that the state primacy is such. You even said in this memo, after all, it is the states, not the federal government, that are charged with protecting the health, safety, and welfare of citizens. That's a pretty broad statement. I take it you had exceptions to it, of course. Medicare, U.S. attorneys, you wouldn't have a job if that was an absolute statement back then. But just tell us a little bit, for a couple of minutes, about your view of the balance between state and federal powers, particularly in light of the changing circumstances we face.
Well, I think you're mentioning those two things, the memo that I wrote when I was in OLC, or that I signed when I was in OLC, and my service as U.S. attorney brings out an important point. I was playing different roles. I had different responsibilities in those two jobs. When I was in OLC, I think what I was expressing in that memo was the federalism policies of the Reagan administration, which, as I mentioned earlier, involved going beyond simply insisting on compliance with constitutional standards. It also involved implementing a policy that certain things should be done at the state and local level, even if the federal government could do that. As U.S. attorney, it was my job to use the legal resources that were available to address the crime problems of the district for which I was U.S. attorney. And I approached that on a basis of cooperating with state and local law enforcement. And my approach was that we should do, the federal prosecutors should do, and the federal investigative agencies should do the things that they were best suited to do, and that it should be a practical division of responsibility. And in many instances as U.S. attorney, we were using far-reaching federal powers. We brought a Hobbs Act prosecution and were stunned when the district court initially threw it out on Commerce Clause grounds because that was virtually unheard of.
All I'm trying to get at here, there is a practical dimension here that I think fits within the Constitution, and you are agreeing with that.
Absolutely, and I think
I just
that,
have to conclude, but go
all
ahead.
Right, Senator, that's fine. Yeah.
Good. Quit while we're ahead on that one. Let me just, in conclusion, Judge, thank you. It's been a long 3 days, obviously. And as your testimony in these hearings comes to a close, I just have to tell you that I remain very troubled, not by anything in your personal history, so much as by your judicial views. You arrived before us this week with a record. It's a record that contains evidence that you believe the Constitution does not protect a woman's right to choose. It's a record that suggests you believe in an executive branch so powerful that it would trump other branches of government. It's a record that makes you appear all too willing to curtail the ability of Congress to look out for the little guy, and a record in which you all too often seem to reach for the legal theory that allows you to side with the large and powerful when average Americans touched by this crushing hand of fate need the most help. Unfortunately, by refusing to confront our questions directly and by giving us responses that really don't illuminate how you really think as opposed to real answers, many of us have no choice but to conclude that you still embrace those views completely or in large part and would continue in a similar fashion on the Supreme Court. So while the process is not yet over, we have written questions, we have some witnesses, the evidence before us makes it very hard to vote yes on your nomination. On the first day of hearings, I said that while you give the appearance of being a meticulous legal navigator, in the end, you almost always choose the rightward course. I'm sorry to say that I haven't heard anything this week very substantive to dissuade me from that opinion, but I thank you for being here and going through these hearings. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Schumer. Senator Sessions, do you have any questions?
Just a few. I would just respond.
Jeff Sessions, Republican of Alabama.
Senator Schumer and Senator Kennedy, and would note that that's not what the ABA has concluded. They've interviewed 300 of your colleagues, judges and lawyers who practiced before you and against you, and they rate you the highest possible rating. They don't see you as an extremist, out of the mainstream or otherwise. And I also want to thank your family for their patience and going through all of this and listening to those of us on this side as we expostulate on all sorts of things. And I see your sister back there in her own right, a nationally known attorney, Rosemary. It's good to see you here. I understand you were debate partners in high school. It must have been an interesting household to have two prominent lawyers growing up. So I'll ask you how that was and who was the best debater.
Well, I'll take the Fifth Amendment on the second part of the question, but it structured our arguments. So instead of arguing about things at home, we would argue about the issues that we were debating. My wife insists that we actually argued a debate in front of her class. We didn't know each other at all at the time, and didn't meet actually for many, many years later, but. We did have a debate at her high school, which was about 20 miles away, and she insists she remembers seeing us debating in front of her French class.
Well, must have been an interesting thing. Apparently, your colleagues in school there were impressed. They predicted you would serve on the Supreme Court one day, and I think that's going to turn out to be a good prediction. I would point out, Judge Alito, that you've been asked a lot about separation of powers, FISA Act, and those kind of things. This Congress has not clarified its position yet. As a judge, if some of these issues were to come before you involving congressional power or something, you would expect the Congress to have formulated its position first, would you not?
Well, that would certainly be very helpful. These are momentous issues. And they're difficult issues, and they've just come to the surface in the last few weeks. And I couldn't begin to say how I would decide any of these issues without going through the whole judicial decision-making process. I think it would be the height of irresponsibility for me to try to do that.
Well, I would agree, and the chairman is going to be having hearings within a few weeks here to discuss many of these issues, and it's something that every senator will be engaged in, whether they desire to or not, and we'll have to think these important issues through, and I don't think they're ripe yet for a decision, that's for sure. I would also note that with regard to Justice Jackson's position on the president and his war-making powers, and the question of when is a high position and a lower ebb position, Chief Justice Rehnquist discussed that idea in Dames and Moore versus Reagan, and in fact pointed out that that doesn't completely answer the question. Those answers are not black and white, and that there's a spectrum running from explicit congressional authorization to implicit or to explicit congressional prohibition. So there's many factors that must be considered. Would you not agree as you analyze those matters?
Yes, you have to know the specifics of the situation.
On the question of jurisdiction of the Supreme Court and whether Congress has the power to contain it in some way, it does appear there's language in the Constitution that indicates that, as you said yesterday. It's there. My question to you is, do you believe that the three branches of government owe it to our country and to our constituents to stay within our bounds and to avoid a constitutional confrontation, a constitutional crisis? Isn't it better that if the courts to restrain themselves, that Congress would restrain itself and not go forward to an ultimate confrontation of those issues?
It certainly is. Now, the issue of the ability of Congress to take away the Supreme Court's jurisdiction over a particular subject of cases is not something that I have previously addressed in writings, unlike a lot of previous nominees who had addressed that, and therefore I think felt that they were freer to discuss that when they came before the committee. That's not something that I've ever addressed in any writing, nor is it something that I've studied other than to read a few, read some of the authorities who have addressed the question. I did mention that I had given a speech expressing the idea that I thought that it was not a good policy idea. I understand the motivation, but I don't think that it's good as a matter of policy to proceed in that fashion. And I don't know what the argument would be as I sit here in favor of taking away jurisdiction over an entire class of cases that would raise some serious constitutional questions.
I would just say to you, I think we ought not to confront that question if we can avoid it. I believe those of us, and that's why I have not joined in legislation, some of which has been filed in this Congress, to take jurisdiction away. But I do believe that is some power that's been given to the Congress. Hopefully it will not have to be utilized. Hopefully that sword will never be drawn because the court will be show restrained and remain within the constitutional powers that they have. With regard to the unitary executive, there are just three branches of government in our Constitution. Is that's correct, is it not?
That's all I see in it.
Well, is every agency and department have to be within one or the other?
I think they do, and that doesn't say that they can't be structured in ways that differ from each other, depending on their function, and that doesn't address the issue of the separate issues of appointment or removal or whether, with appointment and removal, but I think that the Constitution sets up three branches, and everything has to be within one of those branches.
One of the things that I learned as United States Attorney is these agencies think they're independent entities. They think they're almost like nations when they get together. You probably had this experience. They sign memorandums of understanding. Wouldn't you agree they sometimes look awfully like treaties?
They do look like, yeah, they do look like treaties between federal law enforcement agencies and state law enforcement agencies.
But of course, the federal government is one. They can't take two positions in a lawsuit, that's for certain. With regard to interstate commerce, there is a limit to that, to the power of the government, I believe. In the Hobbs Act and the Racketeering Act that Senator Schumer mentioned, doesn't it say within those acts that the extortion or the pattern of racketeering has to affect interstate commerce, and that is an element the prosecutor must prove before a conviction can be obtained?
Yes, that's right. The federal criminal statutes that I'm familiar with, almost without exception, have jurisdictional elements in them. That's the traditional way of casting them. There are a few areas where that's not feasible, such as drugs, but when most of the statutes have jurisdictional elements right in them.
And that's basically the Lopez holding, was it not? And in your opinion in Rybar, you specifically said all the Congress needed to do was to put in an interstate commerce nexus that would be proved to the jury, which I agree with you, having prosecuted hundreds of drug cases, it's not ever been a problem in those cases to prove. That would have solved the problem. Isn't that correct?
That's right. In firearms cases, that's just not a problem.
Well, I think you've served. You've testified extremely well here. You've been most forthcoming. I disagree with the recent comment that you haven't been forthcoming. I would say, and I think Senator Biden indicated, that we've not had a witness more forthcoming, more willing to discuss the issues than you have. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Sessions. I thought we were going to get to that light at the end of the tunnel before 1. Looks like we're going to be a little later than that. But we don't want to take a break now, so to the extent we could move ahead rapidly, it would be appreciated. Senator Durbin, you had originally asked for 10 minutes, but I understand you want more time. How much would you like?
Senator, I will do it as close to 10 minutes as I can, but I might need a few extra. I want to...
All right, let's set the clock at 10 with flexibility to
thank you
exceed
very much.
That.
Thank you.
Richard Durbin, Democrat of Illinois.
Family for putting up with this endurance test, I appreciate your patience throughout. First, let me address the issue of court stripping that was mentioned by my friend from the state of Alabama. I really hope that Congress will never draw that sword. We heard about it during the Schiavo case. If we're going to have a truly independent judiciary, the thought that Congress will take away from the courts issues which we disagree with would really jeopardize it. And just editorializing, I hope we don't reach that point. After you leave today, there will be a panel come before us of your colleagues on the bench from the Third Circuit. Was this your idea that they come and testify?
No, it was not.
Were you asked if it was a good idea?
No, I was not.
Okay. I understand it's never happened before, and that's why I asked you that question. I don't know who came up with this notion, but it does raise some interesting questions, which we've shared on a bipartisan basis about that testimony. But since you weren't involved in that decision-making, I'll drop it at that. Then there will come some public witnesses, and one of those witnesses will raise a contrast between two decisions you made, and I'm going to give you a chance now to respond to that charge or that observation that will be made. Fourth Amendment cases, one we've talked about a lot, Doe versus Grudy, another we've talked about, I think, tangentially, which involves Levetto. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Levetto, or I'm not sure what the pronunciation is. Yes.
Know which case I'm concerned with. In the Levetto case, a veterinarian and his wife, subject to Internal Revenue Service agents coming at 6:30 in the morning, detaining him, patting him down in an Internal Revenue Service investigation, holding him for 6 hours in his office. Then they went to his home, found his wife in her nightgown, patted her down, held her incommunicado for a period of time, and they brought a civil suit and said the government went too far. They didn't have the authority to do those things, to pat us down and search. And your conclusion, writing the majority opinion, was, yes, they did go too far. There was a question about immunity, which I won't touch on, but at least from the Fourth Amendment point of view, you said that the government went too far. Now, of course, the notorious case that's come up time and again of Doe versus Grudy. In that case, of course, it's about a year earlier. There's a search of premises and a John Doe search warrant looking for someone who might have been involved in drug dealing. An affidavit attached to the warrant says that it could also involve persons on the premises who may be hiding drugs. But the affidavit is not part of the search warrant. It's maybe incorporated in general terms. The majority of the court says that it was not incorporated, Judge Chertoff writing for the majority. Particularly egregious is the fact that a mother and her 10-year-old daughter were strip-searched pursuant to that search warrant. And in that case, you concluded that that was warranted, that was acceptable search. So the witness who comes before us is going to say, Judge, how can you do this? You have a veterinarian here and his wife, IRS search. In their case, you said they went too far when they patted it down and searched them. The next case involving a 10-year-old girl in a strip search, you say they didn't go too far. How would you compare the two and draw the distinction between them?
Well, the Loveto case involved the issue of how long they could detain people who were present on the premises while they executed the search of the premises. And they detained these people for a very long period of time.
Six hours, I don't remember.
Or more. It might even have been longer. It was a very long period of time, and there was no warrant for their arrest. There was no claim that there was a justification to seize them other than the fact that they were present on the premises at the time when the search was being executed. The Doe versus Grudy case involved the question of the interpretation of the warrant, and the standard that is to be applied there is the Supreme Court has told us, is a practical common sense instruction. It's not a warrant is not to be interpreted like a sophisticated commercial instrument that's drafted by parties. The facts were, and you mentioned many of them, that the affidavit prepared by the police officer said we have probable cause to search anybody who's found on the premises because we know that we have probable cause to believe that this drug dealer will hide drugs on the people on the premises. And they presented that to the magistrate, and the magistrate issued the warrant, attached the affidavit to the warrant, and said the warrant is incorporated for, and I guess I left out the important fact that the officers, they said we have probable cause to search anybody on the premises, and that's what we want. We want authorization to search anybody on the premises. And the magistrate granted the warrant and attached the affidavit to the warrant and said the affidavit is incorporated for the purpose of probable cause, which meant that the magistrate found that there was probable cause to search anybody on the premises. But in the portion of the warrant where it said person to be searched, it only mentioned
John Doe.
The John Doe. And if this were a bond, I think you'd conclude the only person you can search is John Doe, but it's a warrant. And my view was that viewing this from a practical standpoint, when the magistrate says, yes, you're right, there's probable cause to search anybody on the premises, that's what he's saying. Those are the people he's saying can be searched. But even if one didn't agree with that, you would go on to the qualified immunity question and say, could a reasonable police officer who says, I've got probable cause to search anybody who's on the premises, and that's what I want, and you go to the magistrate, and the magistrate says, I agree with you on probable cause, and here's your warrant. Could they reasonably think that the magistrate is saying, yes, search anybody on the premises?
So did it go into your thinking, this whole question of the dignity of the individual, that we are, in fact, dealing with a mother and a 10-year-old daughter who were subjected to the most intrusive search? Was that part of your thinking in terms of coming down in the minority position and saying it was all right to go ahead with the search? Did you consider that calculation?
I was concerned about the fact that a minor had been searched, and I mentioned that in my opinion, and that's something that's very unfortunate. But the issue in the case was not whether there's some sort of rule that minors can't be searched. That's not part of Fourth Amendment law as I understand it, and there would be a very bad consequence if that were the rule, because where would drug dealers hide their drugs? Minors would then become they would become the repository of the drugs and the firearms.
Or the issuing authority may be more specific in the warrant, which, as I understand it, is what the Fourth Amendment's all about.
Well, the warrant here certainly could have been drafted better, and a lot of...
I think that's what the majority said.
It is, but we have to take into account that these are police officers operating under time pressure, and the Supreme Court has told us that we are not to read these warrants like they're complicated commercial documents. We're trying to get at the practicalities of the situation.
I only have a few minutes, and I will try my best to end it, but I don't think I can do it in two. In our circuit in Chicago, Judge Richard Posner is a very prolific writer about many things. He recently made an observation, which I think really is a challenge to all of us on the Senate Judiciary Committee. We currently have a situation involving immigration cases, particularly those involving asylum and deportation, that we have to look at very seriously. There was an effort to clear the backlog when Attorney General Ashcroft was in charge, and some procedures were changed to streamline the process. And a lot of these cases were just churned out very quickly with very little evidence as to why decisions were being made. Judge Posner made that point recently, publicly stating, if I might quote him, repeatedly, we are left, seeing what he said here, the adjudication of these cases at the administrative level has fallen below the minimum standards of legal justice, he said. Now, you've been involved in some of these cases, about eight of them as we calculate here. There's been a dramatic increase in the number of these cases coming to the federal appeals courts. In one particular case here, the Saidu Dia case, which involved the deportation of a man back to Guinea,
right.
It's a case where he refused to serve in the military. His wife was then confronted in his home country at his home. When they couldn't find him, they beat her, raped her, and burned down his home. And this was a man who said, I don't want to go back because I think it could be a dangerous circumstance for me. In this case, you dissented and said return him to Guinea, that you didn't feel that there was a strong enough case to grant him asylum in the United States and to stay. The reason I raise it is we looked at your record in these cases where there was a split decision, and we discovered that you ruled for the government in 8 out of 9 cases where there was a split decision on these questions, and in 7 of those 8 cases that you ruled in this, 7 of those 8, I should say, yours was the minority position. So my question to you is,